Great. Well, thanks, and thanks for having me here. It's been a lot of fun so far. So, even though Ken didn't make the case, I hope by the end you'll be convinced that it is worth studying mammalian cells in culture and mammalian systems in general. And so I'm not gonna give a lot of background, because I think I started to make that case last week, and I also introduced you to mammalian development last week, so I'll be piggybacking on that talk a little bit. So I just start out by acknowledging the people who did most of the work in my lab. Especially like to acknowledge two postdocs in my lab who did most of the work I'll be talking about today. So one is sitting back there, it's Ian Sherk, who you actually heard about some of his previous work in the last talk. And the other is another postdoc in my lab, Anastasia Nemeskalo, and other people in my lab, and also should acknowledge Eric Sigia and Ali Brivenlu. So the work I'm going to tell you about at the beginning and sort of the start of these projects was done when I was a postdoc with Eric and Ali. So I'm going to tell you sort of three interrelated stories today, time permitting. I'm going to try to go through the first one reasonably quickly, since this is sort of older published work. But this is work about how colonies of embryonic stem cells self-organize in ways that are at least reminiscent of the patterns that form in the mammalian embryo. And then I'd like to talk sort of two stories about zooming in on stem cells in culture and what they're doing and how they're communicating with each other and how that influences the fate decisions that they're making in ways that I think are really would be really difficult to do in really any embryonic system because of the degree of control we have over the cell colonies and our ability to observe them readily. Okay, so we'll start with this. So to give the sort of shortest possible amount of background, we're interested in patterning in a mammalian embryo and patterning at gastrulation stages. And what happens at gastrulation stages is that you have this epiblast, which is shown in red here. Initially, the whole inside would be red and surrounded by this extraembryonic endoderm tissue shown in blue. Somehow, and we talked a little bit last week, it's not entirely clear how, there's an anterior-posterior axis that's defined, so that symmetry is broken, and you get this primitive streak, which is the site of gastrulation on the posterior side, and then those cells on the posterior side differentiate to mesendoderm, and they start to migrate, wrapping around the side of the embryo, eventually making some tri-layered thing with ectoderm, mesoderm, and endoderm, and then extraembryonic tissue surrounding it in that order. And since we're sort of working in 2D culture, I like to imagine this flattened out into this kind of organization. The human embryo is actually flattened. I like to write this as the approximate organization of the human embryo. That's not really true for various reasons you can ask me about later. The primary one being that the human embryo is actually a trilaminar disc, right? So you would have these things as layers on top of each other in this order, not really things as sequences of rings in the embryo. But nonetheless, we sort of think about this thing flattened in this way, and then you have these series of germ layers, and these are sort of the earliest decisions that the epiblast cells are going to go on to form the embryo proper make. So a lot of work over the past 30 years or so has defined a lot of the signals involved in this embryogenesis, and a lot of them are conserved all the way down to flies, right? So you've heard a lot of people talking about DPP, which is the homologue of this BMP4 molecule. It's nodal, doesn't play a very big role in flies, but it's certainly conserved down to fish and frogs, things like that. And the sort of rough story, which I think is all you really need to know to understand the things I'm going to say, is that BMP4 from the proximal extraembryonic tissue, which actually sits on top and is not shown here, induces nodal in the region of the epiblast where gastrulation is going to happen, and there's a feedback from nodal to BMP. So you have these two pathways in this positive feedback loop. It's actually not quite direct, so there's the Wnt pathway in this feedback loop, but I'm, for the most part, going to ignore Wnt in my talk. Okay, so moving from the embryo to stem cells. So stem cells are, roughly speaking, these epiblast cells that I was showing you, right? So these red cells, basically taken out and grown in culture, are human embryonic stem cells. They retain the potential to differentiate to any of the cells of the body. So I could make them into any of these three germ layers. There's increasing evidence that even though this wouldn't really happen from these cells in vivo, that I could make extra embryonic states from them as well. And a lot of the work into stem cell research has been defining protocols that I push cells down these arrows, right? Can I take stem cells and make particular subtypes of mesoderm, particular, say, subtypes of ectoderm, particular neurons or things like that, that ultimately could be useful for regenerative medicine? But I'd like to show you that these stem cells also, besides retaining the capability to make these cell types, they also retain the capability to make these cell types in very refined spatial patterns. And so that allows us to use them to study developmental patterning in culture dish. But it's not totally trivial to get them to do this. So if I imagine taking a field of stem cells and applying this BMP4 ligand, and the theory was, okay, we dump in this BMP4, you get a feedback loop with nodal, hopefully you kick off some kind of gastrulation process and you get some kind of pattern. That doesn't quite work. So you get differentiation, you get fates that would be consistent with that, but they're in some kind of disorganized mess, right? So you see some swath, here's some field of cells marked by DAPI, you see some disorganized swath of mesoderm through these cells, and why is the mesoderm in the center and not on the sides of this thing? And we really don't have a good understanding of why that would happen. And so we thought a little bit about how we grow our stem cells, and they're much more disorganized in their sort of initial state than you would expect from an embryo. And so the stem cells are grown in these colonies, which are epithelial colonies with defined boundaries. This is zoomed way out, as you can see from the scale bar. So the big colonies here have thousands of cells, and the geometries are random. The colonies will merge together at the boundaries, and funny things will happen when they touch. And so none of these kind of messiness is present in an embryo. In an embryo, you always have the same size and shape. And so the first thing we did was we tried to do sort of the best we could by, you know, growing colonies, keeping them separate, trying to grow them from small numbers of cells so they would be sort of nice and round. And we found that even these didn't pattern very well. So we'd get sort of these messy, speckled things if the colonies were sort of embryo-sized. When the colonies got really, really big, you would see sort of patterns that were there, but messy, and with, you know, cells sort of intercalated. And, you know, the length scale of this is much, much bigger. So these scale bars are 500 microns, so these are sort of several millimeters across. So no embryo is several millimeters across. And so we thought, okay, well, we have to do a better job of getting these cells into reproducible geometric structures. And we also thought that maybe the problem here is sort of the cell density. And so in the embryo, right, the cells can't just spread and spread as they would in the culture dish. They're confined. And so one way to solve all these problems, both of these problems, is to use micropattern substrates to grow cells on. And you can produce arrays of cell colonies that look like this. And so this both gives you a reproducible geometric input. So every colony of a particular size looks basically exactly the same. And it also confines the cells so that you achieve much higher cell densities than you would normally achieve in these kind of cultures where the cells are just spreading out. And we thought, okay, maybe these cell densities are important for the communication between cells to get different fates.
So are they protrusion or like holes?
No, so they're, technically the way this works is that you take a glass cover slip, you passivate the surface with something, so a PLL peg, so something that will stick to the surface that the cells won't stick to. Then you burn it off in selected regions with a UV mask, and then you come in and coat with something that the cells do like laminin or matrigel. And so you have islands of extracellular matrix protein surrounded by things that the cells don't like to stick to. So they will only stick there, and then they won't leave those regions. So it's flat 2D culture in defined regions. The other nice thing about this is, as I said, it's very reproducible. It's very quantitative. So this is actually, I think, about 3,000 images pasted together. Okay, so here's a zoom in on one image. You know, we can use standard segmentation to find all the cells. See, here's, you know, each dot is a cell. This is 20 images, so color-coded by image. And then I can zoom back out and back out and back out and back out, right, until I have, right, so this is about 3,000 images on a cover slip. You know, I know what these hundreds of thousands of cells and these thousands of colonies, I can quantify every single one. And so it's a really useful system if you think back to the culture I showed you originally, and you try to ask, what's the average colony doing? It's not even clear what that really means, since they all have these random geometries. But here I could ask, what's the average colony doing, and how often do I deviate from that average behavior? Okay, and here we just, you know, automatically color code by colonies and software. Okay, so that's all good. But the real question is, does it work, right? Do we actually get any kind of reproducible pattern? I guess you might hesitate to call this morphogenesis, but you do get some kind of reproducible pattern of cell density, where you see these sort of sparser cells on the outside, and then this dense ring of cells that I'll show you in a minute is sort of multi-layered, and then this monolayer, which is sparser, in the center. And when you assay this thing for sulfates, you see markers of ectoderm specifically in the center, and then ring of mesoderm around that. And the outside converts to extraembryonic tissue. Okay, and you'll tell me that I missed a germ layer. That's just because we can't stain for everything at the same time. So if I look for eomes, which marks some subsets of mesoderm or endoderm, or SOC17, which specifically marks endoderm, and so these things are sort of sandwiched in between the mesoderm and the extraembryonic, exactly as you would expect them to be. So we get these refined patterns of cell fate. We get them in approximately the correct order, and they're very reproducible, so we can quantify what the average profile of these genes is that mark these different things are doing. So here's profile of average SOX2 expression. Here's an example colony where each cell is color-coded by SOX2 expression. Right, and here you see the ring of brachyury and the radial profile, the SOX17 in the extraembryonic region, and then the CDX2, which marks, sorry, SOX17, which is endoderm, and CDX2, which is extraembryonic, which marks the border of the colony.
It also looked very much like, if you go back a couple of slides, that the endoderm and the green and the red are making sort of radial
space, yes,
at a very defined period out from that mesendoderm area.
Yeah, so that's something we're interested in, and our guess is, so if you actually, we're working on doing live cell reporters for these fates, so we have like CRISPR, say RFP knocked into the SOX17 locus, so we can see a turn on to see the cells move. But we've also just done immunostaining in a function of time. And for most of these fates, except for the ectoderm, you see them first at the colony border and then move inward. And so we wonder whether these sort of trails are actually migrating sort of trails of cells which are dividing as they're moving and making these trails. But on the other hand, it's brachyury we also first see on the colony border, and this is a much cleaner ring. So I don't quite know why that would be. But I think we really need the live cell imaging to say, you know, is it sort of a migration pattern? Is it actually a speckled differentiation pattern in situ? We don't quite have the data yet. Okay, and you can put error bars on these things. I think these are pretty respectable for culture. And then you can start to ask questions about sort of length scales and patterns that are difficult to ask in an embryo. Right? I guess some of you are now perturbing the geometry of flies, but it's maybe hard to make a half-sized fly. It's certainly hard to make a half-sized mouse, but it's easy to make a half-sized stem cell colony and ask what happens to the pattern. And the punchline of what we see in these circles is that the fate, there's basically a single parameter, roughly speaking, that determines the fate or the likelihood of getting a particular fate, and that parameter is the distance from the edge of the boundary. So the patterns form from the edge in. I always make the same sized extraembryonic territory, and then the endoderm territory, and then the mesoderm territory. So if I look quantitatively where this brachyury marker is, right in this bigger colony versus this half-sized colony, the spatial extent of the brachyury marker is the same, and then I run out of room in the middle, so I never make the center marker. So I sort of, by making the colony smaller, I've squeezed out the center of fate.
Can you get bigger? Do you get bigger blooms?
When we make them bigger, we tend to just get more socks too, and we haven't done a lot bigger, but we've done a range. So if we start, you know, get going from here to here, you know, you'll see this SOX2 start smaller, and it will just, you'll just get more and more ectoderm in the center of the colony.
But then there's a size at which the pattern
there's a size at which it breaks down and you'll start to see patches of mesendoderm inside of that. And so we don't quite understand how this works, but we believe that I'll show you some data in a few minutes, that the ectodermal character of the center is maintained by extracellular inhibitors, and they may, we don't know, but it's possible that they in part come from the mesoderm, and so as you get further and further away, it gets less and less of a stable situation. But with that I don't know. Okay, well, so since this is a morphogenesis course, I should say something about cell movements and the physical structure of these colonies. And so what we were interested in is there's a well-defined pathway that mediates this EMT transition, so epithelial to mesenchymal transition in gastrulation that causes the cells to move. Right? So you see these really nice electron microscopy images where I'm looking down at the region of the primitive streak. Right here is the epithelium of the epiblast. Here is where the epithelium is breaking down in the primitive streak, and the cells are migrating out of this epithelium. And there's a molecular pathway, so FGF signaling through the MAP kinase pathway through ERK is required. That leads to upregulation of the transcription factor SNAIL, which is associated with EMT transitions, which does something to E-cadherin, usually downregulation of E-cadherin, and allows these cells to start migrating out of the epithelium. And so we ask how much of this structure is conserved, and so since the brachyury, which is a, sort of my pan-mesodermal marker, is a marker of primitive streak, we would expect these events to take place in the same ring where we see the brachyury.
Ari, can I ask about the, because you made a very strong statement about the parameter that's dictating the patterning is the distance from here.
Yes.
But the range of sizes you had was, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, roughly the same range of sizes you had in your colonies of random geometry.
So the random were much bigger.
They were much bigger.
And there, okay, so.
Can you go around?
Okay, so if we go back there, right, I think the turret, so, okay, let me say a few things. The statement I made, you're right, is a strong statement, and it's probably too strong because it will depend on conditions that influence culture density. So when we started doing this thing, we were coating the cover slips with Matrigel. That turned out to be a large, finicky pain in the butt, and we've now found specific recombinant laminins that do a lot better job. The cells grow denser on these things, and the patterns are the sort of lane scale of the pattern is smaller, although it doesn't seem to be, I can't scale it by cell number, so it's not that there's just a fixed number of those cells. So the more precise statement, I think, is under a particular set of conditions, as I vary the size of the colony, it's the distance from the boundary that's important. But if I change conditions, I could get a changed lane scale there, and part of that has to do with cell density. And there's a large difference in cell density between those sort of randomly patterned colonies, which are allowed to spread, and these confined colonies. That answer here.
Right, yeah, so you can't, it's not just as simple as going back to those irregular
pattern
colonies.
So the
around the edges.
The rough, I'll go way back. Right, so the rough pattern is conserved in these things, right? So I get this green territory, but you see this green territory would actually be like close to 500 microns wide. So it would almost cover, right? If I had this ring, and I imagine getting rid of the center, that would almost be as big as the sort of larger micro pattern.
And yet these smaller guys, which are about 1 millimeter across, is right in your size.
These are right in my, and they don't pattern, right? Because they don't have enough cells, and the density is not high enough, right? So when you, in standard culture, when you have these small colonies, right, they're, because they haven't been confined, right, they don't, but what I think happens is that various extracellular factors are needed to make this pattern, and you don't achieve the densities of those extracellular factors in these cultures. Secretion and diffusion, maybe somehow a cell has to touch a particular number of other cells. We don't know those fine details, but we think density is a very important parameter, and confinement is an important way to increase that density for us. Okay, so the question is this sort of molecular pathway conserved in these stem cells? The answer is mostly yes. So we see a pattern of phosphorylated ERK, which is downstream of this FGF signaling, specifically in this ring where the cells are denser and where we also see brachyury. We see SNAIL which largely colocalizes with brachyury, but not completely, which we think is maybe the signature of these cells starting to move after they express cell because they've undergone EMT. We see changes in sort of E-cadherin localization, but not really in its intensity very clearly. So we see in the part that hasn't undergone EMT, we see this sort of E-cadherin only at the cell junctions. It seems to be somewhat internalized off of the cell junctions in this primitive streak region. So if you, you know, you can put a number on it by saying what's inside the nucleus to what's on the, or what appears to be inside the nucleus to what's on the membrane. But we haven't proven that this is important for the migration. But it, so something happens so that these cells look different for E-cadherin than the cells to the outside. And then if you just look at the sort of rough structure of this colony with 3D image segmentation, right, you see this flat monolayer in the center, this flat monolayer at the edge, and these sort of piled up cells in the middle. And we believe that these are the result of cells leaving the epithelial layer and moving basally into the cover slip. So some evidence for the sort of epithelial character of the top and then the more mesenchymal character of the bottom is if you stain for EpCAM, which marks membranes and epithelial stem cells, right? So if I sort of imagine the, you know, I should really use this IMSTAIN program or something, but if you imagine this curved surface over the top, right, it's completely covered in this epithelial layer, and then in this dense region, you have these cells underneath, which don't have this epithelial marker. And if I play a movie going through and see, right, you see those cells don't have it, and the cells on top of them are epithelial. So we kind of have this epithelial layer covering the top of the colony, and then cells under the epithelial layer where it's two-dimensional, which have a more mesenchymal character. The cells at the bottom layer are the ones that express SNAIL, especially away from this streak region. So if we look in a little box right next to this main region of SNAIL and brachyury expression, the top layer of the culture there won't have any of these cells, and the bottom layer of the culture will have individual cells that express SNAIL, which are maybe migrating away from this primitive streak.
So it is the epithelial-like cells that in isolation express SNAIL, and at the time course, then they move up, become mesenchymal, and sit on top and don't have SNAIL anymore.
They move down. They move towards the culture surface, right. I guess. Is,
okay, move down, internalize,
yes, and they
turn off SNAIL.
They seem to maintain SNAIL. So we think that the cells start in the top layer, which is epithelial. This loses the epithelial character, so we can see that in this EpCAM stain. I'm not showing the data, but if you just stain with phalloidin for actin, you see it not be the sort of cortical actin that you see in the membranes, but sort of a more active actin, and then you see SNAIL expression. And then slightly away from sort of the primary part where that's happening, you see underneath the epithelial layer these SNAIL-expressing cells, which I think you really need to do light imaging to prove this, but we think that they've migrated away from this streak-like region. So, right, so they're recapitulating these gastrulation movements where you involute at the primitive streak. The direction of involution is towards the culture surface, and in some sense the culture surface mimics this layer of extraembryonic tissue that these cells would usually be sitting on. And then they move between the epithelial layer and the basal surface, which is sort of what they would usually do, right? They'd move between the epiblastic epithelial layer and the epithelial layer of the extraembryonic endoderm that's under that. Makes sense. Yeah.
And so then draw attention to the radial striations. Right before, so in this so two-layer morphology, is there any spatial structure, any heterogeneity to this organization, any streaks on the mountain?
Yeah, so these are kind of streaky, right? So if I were to just show you these kind of maximum intensity projections that I showed before, these look sort of ectodermal in character, but you see these kind of streaky things underneath them, and actually they should go in both directions, right? So there should, right, if they're involuting here, they should be moving this way also. Complication of that, I think, is that, as I said, a lot of these markers are first expressed at the colony border. So I think that the streak-like region as a whole is not sitting in one place. It may actually be moving inward in the colony, but individual cells that have left the epithelium are moving outward from it in both directions. Like I said, this is all conjecture from fixed data. Okay, so now, I guess that was the morphogenesis part of my talk. I want to get back to signaling. And so for us, a big question was, the way we do this differentiation is we grow the cells in conditions that would keep them stem cells, and we just dump in a single differentiating ligand, which is this BMB4. And somehow the cells have this heterogeneous response, which makes a pattern along the radial axis of the colony. And so if you draw a sort of phase diagram for what people think about these fate decisions in human embryonic stem cells, adding BMP should upregulate this SMAD1 signaling pathway, and people have shown that that leads cells to convert to extraembryonic trophectoderm. And the other cell fates that we see, like the mesendoderm, typically require some nodal signaling, which is another TGF-beta member family which signals through SMAD2. Pluripotent cells require some nodal and no BMP, and then sort of ectodermal fates require inhibition of them both, although eventually the dorsal ventral axis within the ectoderm will be patterned by the BMP. So it's, I mean, roughly speaking, where the maybe the top half of this is epidermis and the bottom half is actually neural. Or there's some temporal tension where I lose the potential to become trophectoderm, and then if I'm up on the BMP axis, I become epidermis. So the question for us then is, okay, if I'm pushing sort of along the y-axis here by dropping in these signaling molecules, why is it that I see this whole spectrum of fates? Okay, so we started just looking at where the cells are responding to these signals, and it turns out that only the cells at the colony border really seem to be capable of transducing these BMP signals that we're dumping in the media. So if you look at where you see activated SMAD1, which is the proximal signal transducer of BMP, it's restricted to the colony border. That's actually a restriction that becomes sharper in time, right? So the blue line on the bottom is pre-treatment, and then the other lines are increasingly later treatments until at 24 hours, it's quite restricted to a few cell layers from the colony border, which is sort of consistent with this region of extraembryonic tissue that we get. So that part now makes some sense, right? The cells that respond to the BMP signal convert to these extraembryonic cell fates, and the rest of them have only seen sort of transient signals, which are maybe not enough to convert them to extraembryonic fates, but what makes the mesendoderm in between? And so, as I said, nodal is required for mesendoderm, so that was a natural thing to look at. If we look at SMAD2 activity, so the transducer of nodal, it forms a much broader gradient than SMAD1. And it's sort of a transient gradient in time, where you see a large burst of this signal, and then it goes down. So we thought, okay, maybe this is consistent with this mesendoderm differentiation, which actually happens precisely in the region of this gradient. And so it's pretty easy to test that with stem cells. And so what if we add BMP versus add BMP and now inhibit these downstream nodal signaling? And indeed, if we inhibit these downstream nodal signalings, we basically get a binary decision between the cells that respond to the BMP on the outside that become extraembryonic. The cells on the inside are inhibited for BMP. We're also artificially inhibiting nodal, and so they adopt this ectodermal fate where both pathways are inhibited. Right? If I don't have that inhibition, I get these rings of mesendodermal. So we think there's roughly a two-stage model here, right? So something makes you only respond to the BMP at the colony border that converts those cells to extraembryonic and produces nodal, which we know from the mouse data, right? Indirectly, nodal is a BMP target. The nodal makes a gradient across the colony, and then the nodal patterns mesendoderm, perhaps in a graded fashion, where high nodal is endoderm and lower nodal is mesoderm. Yes?
Do these cells start to express any of the ligands, and now they're sort of at a higher concentration than the added stuff, so they're patterning themselves?
So we're looking at that now. The expression So we have SM fish probes for most of these things that are working. The expression patterns are fuzzier than I would have thought for how clean these fate patterns are. And so that's something we don't really understand. So we do seem to have, you know, nodal expression sort of consistent with this ring, right? So it's higher there, but it's still everywhere. And as I'll show you in a minute, it's not only where the nodal is, but actually the inhibitors themselves are important. So we have, maybe I'll show you a little bit more data, and then we could discuss further. Can we show that BMP inhibition is important for making this pattern, and what about nodal? And so we did some knockdown experiments with siRNA. So what happens if I knock down two BMP inhibitors, cortin and noggin? So this double knockdown is known to, the double knockout is known to produce a fairly dramatic phenotype in the mouse embryo, where you lose the anterior tissue, and it produces a fairly dramatic phenotype in our stem cell colonies, where now the BMP signaling encroaches on the center of the colony, and I get sort of inward expansion both of the CDX2 fate and then correspondingly of the response to nodal. And then we also looked at the phenotype of the knockdown of nodal inhibitors. So if we knock down lefty and Cerberus, we actually get a subtly different... Sorry.
Can I ask something?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. So if you showed this phase diagram of... dependent on how much BMP and nodal you put on, you get different. So I was wondering, so if you want to kind of prove or justify this phase diagram now with the stem cell layers, but I wondered how did they then find this phase diagram, or actually you, how did you find
okay,
it?
Okay.
You didn't do like the...
Okay, so this is... I won't claim this is actual data. So the citation on the bottom is a review article.
Okay.
And this is supposed to summarize sort of the thinking in the stem cell field. And I think part of that is so people have done a lot of work, as I said, on trying to produce pure populations of cells. Right? So I can actually very effectively generate trophectoderm with BMP only under the right conditions. Right, I can generate mesendoderm by adding enough activin under the right conditions. And it's a very good protocol for making neural tissue just by inhibiting these two pathways. So if I grow stem cells in normal stem cell media, but put in inhibitors to both of these pathways, I get almost 100% conversion to neural. So this diagram is basically summarizing a lot of directed differentiation experiments. So people who have pushed on particular axes of these things and seen differences. And so, I'm not trying to justify this phase diagram. What I'm actually trying to do is understand our patterning experiments in light of this phase diagram, right? So we know that there are ligands associated or pathways associated with particular fates, but we're not stimulating all those pathways. We're only stimulating one of them, and we're getting a whole spectrum of fates. So if we actually look at where the activity of the pathways is downstream of our exogenous stimulation, does it make sense with this picture? And so what I'm arguing now is that on a rough level it does, right? Where I see the BMP response, I get trophectoderm. Where I see the activin nodal response, I get mesendoderm. Where I don't see a response to either, then I get this ectoderm in the middle. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you.
Ari, can I ask you to go through here on those amazing patterns of the SMADs, the SMAD localization?
So,
are you detecting phosphorylated, or are you detecting...
Okay, so I'm doing exactly what it says. For SMAD1, I'm detecting phosphorylated SMAD1. For SMAD2, we've gotten better at this, but we had trouble with the phospho-SMAD2 antibodies, and we also want... So this is actually the same colony with the co-stain, so we have a very good... The rabbit phospho-SMAD1 works well. We have a good mouse total SMAD2. And what we're actually quantifying is the nuclear cytoplasmic ratio of the total SMAD2. So here, we're quantifying the total amount of phospho-SMAD1 in the nucleus. Here, we're quantifying the ratio of SMAD2 in the nucleus to the cytoplasm. So it's not quite the same thing. But I think now, in much more recent data that we haven't published, we see similar patterns with the phospho-SMAD2 antibody.
So it would also be true to say that the cells on the right-hand side, when you look at SMAD2, those cells have also increased net amount of SMAD2 that they've got?
It certainly looks like that in this picture, but I don't think that's true. So you have to be quite careful about the quantification. So when you aggregate a lot of SMAD2 in the nucleus, you just tend to see these brighter dots as opposed to when it's spread throughout the cell. And so I think what you're seeing there are the brighter dots of the nucleus. So especially at this resolution, you can't really tell. We've done a lot of watching of SMAD shuttling between nucleus and cytoplasm in living cells, and we don't see large differences in total expression of SMADs. It's really about where it is in the cell. Okay, so we get these phenotypes of inhibitors. This is a little bit complicated to understand, mostly because the CDX2 gene is actually also expressed in the mesoderm, and so when it's extraembryonic, it's when it's there in the absence of brachyury, right? So this region on the outside of these colonies that doesn't express brachyury but does express CDX2 is extraembryonic. Here, where you express it everywhere but you also express brachyury everywhere, you're basically converting the whole colony to mesoderm, right? So here, basically, I've shifted the whole pattern inwards with extraembryonic broader territory and then mesoderm, and then almost lost the center character of the middle. Here, we've initiated this feedback loop. The BMP turns on the nodal, but there's nothing restricting the nodal activity in the absence of these inhibitors, so the nodal activity spreads and then converts the whole colony to mesoderm.
So are there any perturbation which moves the position of the brachyury circuit? So you say that the cells measure its distance from the monoery. So
yes.
Do you have conditions where you would move this distance?
So a couple of things. So there are some that I consider sort of boring conditions where that happens, which is if I change the culture substrate and the cell density, it moves. If we change signaling levels, it does move, although we don't, and patterns get perturbed, and we don't totally understand all that data. So one thing we're working on that we don't really understand, I'm not going to talk about today, is we've actually made these. So we have a company now that can make these things for us at 96 well plates. And so we can try lots of different combinations of BMP and activin and Wnt and all this stuff and get a pattern as a function of what we put in. And we see some of them don't pattern very well. Some of them we see different kinds of patterns. So it is possible to shift these patterns with ligand levels, but we don't have an understanding of how that's working.
Can I vary viscidness of the matrix just by adding a couple of more guys or something, keeping the amount of lamin the same, but just varying viscidness?
Yeah, so that would be quite interesting to do. We're not really growing them on a gel, right? We're growing them on a sort of molecular layer of laminin. So I think for our purposes, this is infinitely stiff. It's basically the stiffness of the glass.
Right.
We haven't tried very hard, but we haven't been able to make a gel of Matrigel on top of this thing. We were using Matrigel for a technical reason. If the Matrigel would polymerize at all, it would ruin this whole thing, because I guess the cells are capable of just ripping the polymerized Matrigel off the micro pattern, and then they would just float away. I think we need to talk to some more sophisticated bioengineering types about how to pattern softer substrates. And I know people do, it's a thing people do, it's definitely technically feasible, but we haven't done it. Okay, now I'm going to get into some newer data on this where we've started to look at the effect of perturbing the shape of these colonies. And here, what I think is most interesting is that this sort of one parameter relationship between the distance to the boundary and the cell fate starts to break down. Right? So we sort of designed these different shapes to ask different kinds of questions, right? So if you cut out territories of these colonies, do you see an effect of communication across the boundaries of these colonies? Or if you start breaking symmetries in these circles or introducing corners and things like that, do you see an effect of doing that? Okay, so here's some data from a bunch of different regular shapes. So these, I think I may have messed up the scaling of the different pictures, but these are chosen so that they all have exactly the same area. So the area is the same, but the shape is obviously different. And that here you start to see deviations from this rule that the distance from the boundary is what matters, right? So it's clearly not true that the distance to the closest boundary is the most important thing, right? So it's easiest to see in these kinds of corners here, where you see this territory shift in from the corners. Or here, right, you see this red territory, which is much broader at the corner than on the sides, right? And so if you just, these look like cartoons, but they're kind of real data. If you just take these images and then binarize or discretize them, so they're color-coded by, on average, over many colonies, what is predominantly expressed at that localization, right? You see the circle gives you this basically isotropic thing. If you do an ellipse, it's pretty close to that. But as you start to get to more acute angles of the corners, you start to see effects of these corners. And we're, this is pretty new data, so we're still sort of thinking about this. So sort of naively to me, it actually looks like the outer states are more sensitive to these sort of more acute angles, whereas this intermediate phase becomes the most sort of broader in these sort of 90 degree angles, and as you get bigger than that, you lose it. I don't know if that's true.
Right, and that's exactly what would make you think that stresses were important, probably, by analogy with this Chen's experiments where you can measure stresses at the corners of the patterns, and then...
So you actually have some intuition that patterns would just work? That's
based on the adhesions to metrics at corners,
I would disagree because the scale here is much, much higher than Chris was making. And the stresses that you see in those guys are maybe 3 or 4 cell diameters in from the edge. I don't know. Maybe that's enough to produce.
So some of these are, this is probably 3 or 4 cell diameters, this red territory. Here. This is more. Right now, here it gets to be like 7 or 8. So,
it'd be interesting as cell boundary markers to just see if you could detect the way the cells were stretched and stuff.
Well, for example, yeah, if you were solving a diffusion equation with an absorbing boundary,
the
diffusion field would cut some of its corners just like that. Right?
Yeah, so that's what we're starting to do now, is just, you know, play with Turing or Meinhardt type models on these kind of shapes. And see if you generate some morphogen, and then you're thresholding the morphogen, or will leaving the situation a little more complicated because you have these two morphogens, so it's the interplay between the two of them. But yeah, we're really interested in sort of putting some diffusive equations on this and asking whether you can predict these patterns that we haven't done.
So you showed the one pattern with this kind of isolated outer ring, and the conclusion there was that the...
I'll get to that. Okay, let's first just a little bit more sort of quantitative data from these shapes. So you can sort of quantitate this effect that I showed you. Here we've sort of, a little bit complicated, so we've, the range of the angles sort of reflects the symmetry of the thing. So we fold, right, the triangle has 3 symmetric segments around each corner. We folded all that data together into one thing to maximize the amount of data, right? And so you see, as I look at the triangle, right, this is sort of the inner phase, right, I see a dip in the outer region and a corresponding bump up in the inner region, right, the outer phase is somewhat bumped up in the inner region. And actually, as I said, sort of for this inner phase, it seems to be most sensitive to the square, right, I see this very nice, I should say these dashed lines are the corners, right, so I'm looking as a function of angle, this is the corner of the square, right, and the range of angles here is 90 degrees because it basically goes from here to here, right, and this bang in the middle is the corner, right, so when, and the shaded things here indicate the sort of positions from the boundary that I'm averaging over, right, so here's things closer to the boundary, here's things farther from the boundary, right, and I see this angular dependence, and by the time I get to this pentagon, it's almost gone, right, so I guess like the corners are not acute enough to see this. Okay, so now, you get to Boris's question, what about these shapes that we designed to look at diffusion? What we are doing here primarily is looking at the patterns in each of these segments separately and asking how similar it is to what you would expect if the other part wasn't there. So to start with the circle in the middle, I don't have control data from the same experiment with a circle from the same size yet. But since we know what's really important is distance from the boundary, right? So if this line is the inner boundary, if you look at these cell fates as a function of the inner boundary, they look almost exactly like the left half of this curve. And so we can't see any difference between a circle inside this ring and what you would expect from if the ring weren't there. So there's no, there doesn't seem to be any sort of inward diffusion from the ring over these scales, which are probably 3 or 4 cell diameters. On the other hand, if we look in the opposite direction, we do see some effect, which is relatively small. But if I compare the ring to the ring with a small circle to the ring with a large circle, the expression of the fates that are supposed to be in that ring is enhanced, right? So this is the CDX2 fate, right? This is this blue green curve is this, this red curve is this, and this blue curve is this. So I get more and more expression of this CDX2 marker, which is for this edge fate, as I make this thing in the middle bigger. So we actually have no idea what this means. I'm a little squeamish even about it. And want to do it more times to make sure, but the sort of naive punchline is that somehow there's an influence of the cells on the inside, on the outside, and we obviously know that there's information that propagates from the outside to the inside without this cut there, because cells basically are determining their position from the boundary. So this somehow suggests that to me that the information propagates in, and then some sort of outward influence is important for reinforcing the character of the boundary phase, but they're very preliminary.
So the logic here is that something is actually secreted, goes into the media, and then it's picked.
Yeah, it's so
picked up by the cell, right? And
rather
than I would think most of these ligands just diffuse along the surface of the cells, in which case they can't really propagate.
Right.
So that's separating the.
Yeah. Two so naively, I didn't expect to see anything.
So
we haven't.
But if it has to be secreted into the media, ultimately it depends, you know, how much media is in your dish.
Yes. Although, so we think that maybe the mixing in the bottom layer of the media is very poor, so you can effectively get. You don't believe that.
Whether the cells have protrusions, or I know a cell, they're not going to sit on that nasty stuff in the middle, but maybe they can.
Yes, that is possible, and they will. Most of the things we stain for label nuclei. So we haven't looked. Actually, I don't know that we've looked at that under these conditions. So it's possible. It's possible that there's some of that bridging. It's possible that there's some sort of extracellular matrix that's capturing the ligands in between that gets deposited somehow. I sort of agree with what Boris is saying, that we see this effect, but mechanistically how it would happen, I expected to see nothing here.
So Boris, can you're talking about you think there's some major convective flow in typical dish?
Well, you know, this kind of physics, in order to prevent convection there, you would have to control temperature.
But there's no
any horizontal differential temperature will sort of start driving the flow. Yeah. It's very difficult to convection.
And there's no boundary layer that has interaction. I mean, because it really only have to be a very thin boundary layer that doesn't mix.
Well,
So
that's actually not that hard to estimate. We know what viscosity is.
We should talk about this. Yeah, so we're actually thinking about trying to do it experimentally by making secreted GFPs and seeing, you know, if they totally get lost in the media, or you can see things along the surface. But we haven't done that yet either. Okay, so now I want to briefly mention what I think is a very interesting experiment that Itza did. And he had this idea that, you know, we see this seemingly dominant effect of the boundary, but what if I could make a colony that had approximately the same size but had no boundary? And so the way that he did that was to take a bead and coat the bead with laminin, and then to grow the cells in an epithelial layer on the surface of the bead, and then to treat them in the same way. And so our sort of very naive expectation was, okay, well, you know, if there's no boundary, the whole thing is like center. So somehow, you know, I should just get the center face on these things. So that's not what happens. These things can somehow break the symmetry of the bead. and you end up with, so here you're looking at markers for brachyury, so this is a cross-section through the bead, and here he's used his IMSANE program to map at least half the bead onto a plane, right? So you see this territory of brachyury expression. You see these spread out cells, which are almost certainly trovectoderm. And so these, in response to this homogeneous ligand stimulation, these have somehow undergone some kind of spontaneous symmetry breaking process that makes these patterns. And so we're sort of kicking around the idea of whether there's some sort of Turing instability which you can kick off, which makes these patterns. And what the role of the boundary usually is just to bias that instability, but it's not necessary.
Does it matter how big the beads are?
I don't think we know that yet.
Are they resting on the bottom of the?
No, so they're in a shaker. So we thought about it. So they're kind of constantly agitated.
So it looks like the blue side is more of a monolayer, and the green side is piled up. So is this the consequence of differentiation?
So it's just done time points here, and from the earliest brachyury expression, you see polarization. So it's not that they randomly differentiate and then aggregate on one side of the bead. They differentiate there.
But it started as a monolayer.
It started as a monolayer. So I think this is similar to the phenomenon where we get this piling up in the primitive streak region in the flat colonies. So the brachyury cells undergo EMT and pile up. So I think the causality is that way. And we were interested in that, so he did these time series to the earliest expression that he could see, and we never see random brachyury expression.
Maybe you say, but is it a ring, or is it, you have the brachyury ring?
No, it's like a patch.
It's a patch. Okay.
So I think in the sort of self-organized stem cell patterning literature, right, people tend to feel systems like this are better than the systems we have because there's a spontaneous symmetry breaking event. And they like to call this axis through the bead an anterior-posterior axis. I feel more squeamish about that because, if you think about this thing, it has the same cylindrical symmetry as our colony, right? I could draw a pole through this brachyury patch and it would just be symmetric around it. So I've basically broken one symmetry to recover the cylindrical symmetry that the colonies have to start with. So I don't know that I should call this an AP axis any more than I should call the axis along the radius from the brachyury ring to the edge of the colony an AP axis. But it is true that there's a symmetry breaking here that happens that doesn't happen in the colony. Okay, and so he also sort of fortuitously discovered that if you have two of these beads and they happen to stick together, you get a particular pattern of differentiation such that one bead makes one fade, in this case ectodermal, the other bead makes these extraembryonic, and you get mesoderm glummed between the two beads. I don't think we have any idea how this works, but it's pretty striking.
Negative curvature.
Maybe. Maybe it's just cell density that you have more cells where the beads are stuck together, but it's sort of an interesting way to bias the system to make things. And then,
it's a sharp corner. Is that what happens at your sharp corners in your triangles? In your
we do see an enrichment for brachyury at sharp corners, but some distance from the boundary. Right?
The size of the beads, I guess they're in a shaker. So are these, if I was to look at these beads in time, which I'm sure it's a can, are they moving at all relative to each other? Or they, I guess I'm asking, are there forces now that are holding this and it's somehow that's getting the...
But I don't know. What are you...
How big are they, I guess, compared to, how big are these beads?
So they're like 300 microns diameter.
So I guess there's no thermal agitation at these beads. They're not jiggling. They're too big for jiggle.
But the shaker jiggles at all times they're sort of bouncing around.
I see.
Yeah, so I don't.
So it's certainly not the fusion of like morphogens.
But you think are you asking, are the beads that are in between, the cells that are in between the beads under some kind of tension from being stuck to beads that are maybe moving differently?
Yeah, it's morphogenesis.
I don't know. It's an interesting idea, but I think it'd be quite... It'd be quite difficult to image. Well, it's difficult to measure those kind of forces. It'd certainly be quite difficult to image them on a shaker.
Yes. Because a What exactly would the experiment
be? So you mean how do we do it? So you just you have these beads that are made of like polystyrene or plastic or something, I think. You can get glass ones also. And then so we just soak them in a laminin solution, which is what we would normally coat the cover surface of things. And then you incubate these coated beads with cells. And so the cells stick onto the surface of the beads. And when they stick, they make an epithelial monolayer. So they cover the if you're lucky and you do it right, they cover the surface of the bead homogeneously. And so the idea is that it's, you know, still a two-dimensional colony, but now it has no boundary, right? We've taken these things, which are usually disks in our experiments, and made them into spheres that have no boundary. And so the question is, was the boundary absolutely required for patterning? And the answer is no.
So you probably don't have much of a way to test this, but maybe you have some intuition about it. Do you think in these two bead scenarios, are these two beads that were always together and then it was one colony that grew this way, or was it two colonies or two beads that fused?
I think you see beads stuck together before differentiation.
This is a single colony that grew this
way. I think this is a single sort of double beaded colony, that this is the differentiation pattern that you see on it. I mean, we can't exclude that some of these things we see are things that stuck together later, but I guess I would imagine that once you sort of make an epithelial layer covering one bead, it's not going to stick as well to another epithelially covered bead. Although I don't know for sure.
Can you just make a bead that is the shape of the embryo?
Maybe. So we have talked to some bioengineers about making beads, but we're still just buying these from like Sigma or something, right? You can buy polystyrene beads from Sigma in different shapes. There's some companies, sort of obscure, that sell randomly shaped beads, but they seem to be focused on things that are like 10 microns big. So that's obviously, you know, you get like three cells on it or something. So, I think there's other things where, you know, since the embryo is sort of cup-shaped, you could certainly imagine, you know, making a cup-shaped kind of thing out of PDMS that the cells would stick to, and we've talked about that, but we haven't done it. Well, the mouse embryo is sort of, I mean, I guess, sort of in defense of our original system, right, the human embryo is basically a flat disk sitting on the extra-embryonic tissue, so the sort of original geometry of our colonies is quite good compared to the embryo. Where it breaks down is that, you know, you have this gastrulation process that makes it three-dimensional that can't properly happen on a whole surface. But in terms of the sort of starting material for a human embryo, these sort of monolayered epithelium and circles are actually pretty good, I think. Okay, so the last thing I want to say, half an hour left or something. So the last thing I want to say quickly in this part of the talk is one thing we wondered about is how general is the strategy we're pursuing here. So here I've taken embryonic cells, which are progenitors of all these different fates. I've constrained their geometry, and then I've forced them to differentiate. But what if I had cells that were restricted to a germ layer, and then I were to apply the same strategy, right? So George Britton in my lab had the idea of, okay, let's put them down. Let's force them towards neural, or really ectodermal differentiation for 3 days by inhibiting both of these pathways, and then let's hit them in BMP which within the ectodermal germ layer should induce at different doses epidermis, or within the ectodermal germ layer it should induce epidermis or neural crest depending on the dose. And so can we get patterned ectoderm with this strategy? It turns out that interestingly, we have to inhibit nodal to do this. So if we don't inhibit nodal, even after 3 days pushing towards ectoderm, these cells still retain the capability to make mesoderm, even though they've actually lost the capability to make this outer extraembryonic layer. So if we push them this way for 3 days and hit with BMP, this brachyury ring will actually end up on the outside of the colony instead of all the way in. But if he, so what he wanted to do was make these ectodermal patterns, and if he does this protocol, so he can get pretty nice patterns where the neural fates are right in the center. We get neural crests around that. We're still working on good antibodies for epidermis, but we see some keratin staining sort of mixed and slightly to the outside of this neural crest. So we can, following You know, I'm sort of shoving a year of George's work into one slide, because there's a lot of optimization here, but following the same sort of general strategy, you know, we can generate patterned tissues within one germ layer, and they this shows similar properties, right? If I shrink it down, I shrink down the center neural territory. He's actually pursued this strategy even later in neural development. I don't know why he gave me these fuzzy pictures, but So if you grow cells to a certain point, to where they're neural progenitors, they'll actually self-organize in culture and make these things that look like neural tubes with a lumen in the center. And so we thought, okay, let's see if we can self-organize these things on the patterns and see how the pattern scales to the size that's available to it. And it seems to scale, but not completely, right? So if I have these small 100 micron circles, right, I get this one rosette with this lumen kind of thing in the middle and this marsh progenitor cells and this nest in, well, it's mostly marking these neurons. If I make this thing bigger, I actually get two of these rosettes in the culture, and the rosettes look bigger, but they don't seem to have been able to scale to cover the whole thing, or I don't know if it's a dynamic thing. So we're sort of interested in pushing on this to see, you know, as we vary this more finely, is there some sort of transition between getting one rosette and two rosettes and what's going to happen in time.
So how big are these rosettes?
The left is 100 microns, this is 200. So the left whole circle is 100 microns, this is 200 microns. So, and these are, right, this is like a nucleus, I don't know if you can tell, right? So there's, I don't know, 100 cells.
This red hole is a single cell or multiple?
No, so this red hole is multiple cells that have made a lumen here.
So it's really a lumen. Okay.
It's really a lumen. We haven't gotten to, so people have shown that it will, you get a nice lumen stained with N-cadherin in these things, and these actually have the properties of the develop. These things have some of the properties of the developing nervous system, so you get these interkinetic nuclear migration along the radial axis of these things, and cell division at the lumen.
Is that lumen open? Is it flat and it's two-dimensional, or is it actually a three-dimensional cyst that you're sectioning through here?
Yeah, so I actually don't, that's something I don't know, and people in, when I was in a Lee Brievenlew's lab, people made these things all the time, and I was always trying to get them to just like inject a dye or something to see if it, and we never did it. So hopefully now that we're doing this in my lab, we'll look at that kind of thing. I haven't seen that answered. So people grow these all the time in the literature. I don't know the answer to that.
Why is nest in that lumen, but it's also around the outside?
Yeah, so that
is nest marking like a junctional, an apical.
Yeah, so we were actually surprised to see, you know, it was sort of fortuitous for these stains because you can actually see these lumens. But in the past, right, and you certainly get much better staining on the outside. And the inner the lumen on the inside in the literature is mostly negative for nestin and should be positive for N-cadherin. So I don't know if that's real expression or antibody background, but here at least it serves to show where the lumen is.
I liked your thing that your system is not so dissimilar from it's as if you use the center of yours is the thing of his. But then his two-bead experiment, I guess my question is, what if you took two of your circles, intersected them, there'd be a region of negative curvature, and therefore you could test Boris's hypothesis, which is it forces or is it negative curvature of the geometry? Because if you've got mesoderm things turning on in the region of negative curvature, then you know why it's happening in its system.
Yeah, that's actually a very good idea. So we've generated a bunch of these shapes, and I don't think any of them have negative curvature. So
who's got the Pac-Man shape?
Yeah, the Pac-Man shape. That's true.
Yeah. Okay. So we should. So we should look more closely at. We sort of made that for fun, and then. Easier to analyze these sort of, you know, regular polygons. But we could look at the Pac-Man and see if it's consistent with that. Good thought. Okay, I'm going to try to speed up a little bit. So I'd like to tell two more stories if I have time. So the next story is that we really wanted to get into dissecting, you know, how the cell-cell communication works in these colonies, and in particular, how can we separate out the effects of things that are floating around in the culture media from things that the cells are actually sending to each other. And so we had this idea, okay, so we're thinking about stem cells, their epithelium is not nearly this organized, but it's easier to draw it this way. And if I think about one cell sitting in the epithelium, right, I'm adding some media with growth factors, and that's doing something, but it's also, in theory, talking to all of its neighbors. So can I dissect the contributions of these two things? So we had this simple idea that since we can control our colonies, can I just get rid of the rest of the colony and just have a one-cell-sized colony, see what happens? Then I can add another cell, and ask, is a two-cell colony different from a one-cell colony, different from a three-cell colony, and so on. Okay, so we made this, we use the same approach to make these very small colonies, and if you optimize your seeding conditions, you get a spectrum of different sizes. In our case, we have pretty good coverage from about 1 to 8 cells per colony, and you know these things are easy to image and segment, and so you can start to look at things as a function of colony. And also, the hope was that it would help us directly answer questions like, are these ligands that we're adding that everyone calls morphogens, do they really function as morphogens, right? So you have, say, BMP ligand, people say it's a morphogen, but if you have totally isolated cells and you add different doses of BMP, do you actually get different phase or not? Okay, so here's some pictures of that experiment, right? So I'm adding different doses of BMP. And what follows, I'm just using two markers. So the SOX2 is a proxy for stem cells. We've shown that they express, you know, SOX2 can mark ectoderm, but not if they're also co-expressed with other stem cell markers like NANOG4, and these cells do express that. And then these cells under BMP differentiate almost entirely to extraembryonic tissue in these small colonies, which is the boundary of our large colonies. And you see this dose-dependent effect. So if we don't add any BMP, we get these stem cell colonies. We start to add a little bit of BMP, right? You see, you know, there's one colony there that converted. Add a little bit more, and now you have some colonies that are still stem cells, but most of your colonies have converted. Add a little bit more, and now basically everything's become extraembryonic. So we get a very sharp transition between stem cells and extraembryonic cells. We don't see any evidence of a morphogen effect when we treat with BMP in these small colonies. Yes?
Interestingly, it's just one of, it converts the whole colony.
Yeah, okay, that's the whole point I'm getting to. So yes, you've identified my punchline already. Okay, so here's some data that shows there's a very sharp conversion. They're actually, the interaction between cells often tend to repress this BMP pathway because take the patterns I showed you in the last section, we need 50 nanograms per ml, and you can see how far off the chart that is here. So in isolated cells, they're exquisitely sensitive to these ligands. Here's some single cell data showing this conversion from SOX2 expressing cells to CDX2 expressing cells. Yeah.
Is it bistable if you removed it? Would it stay in its elevated, in its new state? Is it sort of differentiated, quote-unquote?
We haven't done that. That's a good question. I mean, I think probably, so these are 2-day-long experiments.
Oh,
I think probably by the end of 2 days it is, but it would be an interesting exercise to withdraw it at various times and see if it...
See the sort of hysteresis, right?
Yes.
You'll see some curve.
Yes. Okay, so right, we noticed the exact phenomenon that, you know, Boris just started. And so what if I make the plots I just showed you, but I color code them by how many cells are in the colony? So blue are fewer cells, red are more cells, right? And you see these immediate effects, which are sort of clear here, right? So when you have low doses of BMP, the larger colonies are better at staying stem cells, and the smaller colonies differentiate more readily. And when you have higher doses, it's a little bit harder to see here because you've killed the SOX2, but the stuff that really expresses the CDX2 are the things in the larger colonies, whereas the smaller colonies, in some sense, sometimes they differentiate, but they sort of fail to differentiate to the right fate instructed by the BMP ligand. Okay, so this reminded us of some old work from John Gurdon, right, who called this the community effect, right? So if you have cells, so what he did was he had cells from the animal calf of Xenopus. He put them either so they'll be converted to mesodermal fates by the vegetal tissue. So he put them in sandwiches of vegetal tissue, either sort of as these isolated cells or as lumps of cells, and saw that they were only effectively converted when they were in these lumps of cells. In some sense, this is a sort of more precise observation of the same thing in the human system. So here's just a single image which kind of shows this. So the nuclei are marked in green, and they're under different, they're under conditions that should differentiate them to red. And you see the things that turn really yellow are the things that are in larger colonies, right? So this, the single nuclei sitting by itself right next to all this stuff that's differentiating has failed to differentiate.
You said it isn't a morphogen, but in a way it is a morphogen because it was dose dependent. But it's like, I mean, because you added different amounts and you got different responses. But there's
okay. So to me, a morphogen. Okay. So I guess my definition of a morphogen that I was using is something that has more than one, induces more than one fate in a dose dependent way. This is a binary. So I guess we can, maybe that's semantics, but
you're looking at one fate.
Yeah, so
could
we,
be a morphogen.
Could, but so we've looked at a lot of other, right? We've looked at Brachyury, we've looked at SOC 17, we've looked at markers of all kinds of other stuff. We don't see anything else. And it's a very high fraction of the cells that express the CDH2.
It could be I don't know if you trigger or something release factor that allows you to see something. I guess that would be the distinction. I don't know. We don't
want
to go there in that discussion.
Yeah, so I guess my sort of definition of morphogen is influenced by these experiments that, you know, Jim Smith and John Gurdon did in the 90s, where they took dissociated animal cap cells, exposed them to different doses of activin, and showed that there was a spectrum of four or five fates as you increase the dose. This doesn't seem to be like that. There's a fairly sharp switch between stem cells and differentiated cells. So it's sort of... Yeah, I
look at different differentiation markers.
So I'm not showing you the data, but we've looked at a bunch of different stuff, and we see almost nothing else. And the other thing is that once you get to colonies of, say, three or four cells, the differentiation is very, very close to 100%. Okay, so here's the data. Right. So when I think about the stem cell fate, right, so here's cells in undifferentiated conditions, my marker for undifferentiated conditions. You know, they don't do a very good job of expressing it when they're alone, but quickly as I get up to four cells, 100% of them express it. My differentiation marker, right, shows the opposite trend. Now, when I switch to differentiated conditions, right, the whole thing flips, right? So my stem cell marker is only expressed in small colonies of cells and then completely goes away, whereas my differentiation marker turns on, right?
Arya, do you find... I'm going to sound like a lot of the work that came out of Princeton in the embryo, but I'm using that to, I mean, so do you find that when you have more cells, or could you summarize your data with saying when there's more cells, they measure the concentration better and are able to respond to some particular value on one side of it or the other, and if it's a single cell, it's more noisy.
Should I think of it
like that?
Yeah, so I was thinking about that just the other day, and so what I think we should do, which we haven't done, is plot the dose response curves to the ligand as a function of colony size.
That's right.
I don't have that data, but I think that's true, right? So sort of what we see is that if I imagine, you know, in the undifferentiated state, I'm giving them signals to become stem cells,
that's
the cells are poor, single cells are poor at interpreting those signals, whereas larger numbers of cells are better. If I remember correctly, there was some argument about actual numbers of molecules and stuff.
I don't think we have
small numbers of molecules, but the punchline is the same.
Yeah. You could imagine that, you know, it increases the local concentration of the BMP because it could bind any of the cells and move around and diffuse on the cells if you're big, but and then once they bind to your neighbors, they have a less chance of coming off again, and you increase the local concentration, as opposed to if you're one cell.
Yes, or, I mean, some of these things are their own targets, right? I think BMP4 is a BMP target, so you can imagine where it responds, then it secretes BMP, and then you get some higher local effect of BMP.
But that model is a kind of a cell communicate, the cell that gets it, makes it, and that then amplifies the decision for the surrounding cells. So it does...
But they all get it. It's like if some cell makes a mistake, the neighbors correct it.
That's right.
Sense,
yeah.
Right.
But they correct it because there's a molecule that's moving from this cell to cell. And I was wondering if there's any other explanation for the community.
I have that model because of some data that I'll hopefully get to show you in a minute. So we have some dynamic data on how the response to these signals happens in these colonies, which hopefully I'll get to. well. So since this is sort of a theory thing, I want to just briefly mention that you can actually very effectively model this thing as an icing magnet, right, where the two cell fates are like up and down spins, right? Then you have some external magnetic field, and then you have some interactions that tend to align the spins, right? And so you basically have, you know, if you subsume the temperature into the parameters, you basically, right, have an interaction term and a field term. I guess the field term is different depending on the ligand dose, but, right, there's some, basically, you know, you assume there's some either linear or sort of Michaelis-Menten function between ligand and field, and if you assume that, right, so with those two parameters, you can basically fit all this data quite well. So it, I think there's a binarization of the data that goes into this, right, which is not really there. So some of these pictures, if you look at them, it's not only that they, you know, the expression of these markers is not really binary. They actually get brighter as you have more and more cells. But if we do binarize the data, we can fit it very well. So here's some other data that we didn't use in the fit. It all works well. But I want to have time to get to this. So we're interested in molecularly, how does this community effect work? And there's really two community effects, right? So one is pluripotent cells reimpersing the pluripotent fate, and the other is differentiated cells all differentiated, same thing. And there's roughly four pathways involved in pluripotency and differentiation, right? So there's this FGF pathway and the activin pathway both maintain the stem cell state, and the WNT and BMP pathway both differentiate cells. And so we decided to see, okay, if we artificially inhibit these pathways, can we substitute for the community effect? Okay, so here's some things that don't work, right? So maybe if I inhibit the WNT differentiation pathway, if the cells are passing WNT inhibitors between them, then, you know, I won't need to have more cells. I have this WNT inhibitor floating in the medium. That makes no difference. I won't show you the data, but inhibiting BMP makes no difference. So maybe the cells are passing nodal back and forth, which could reinforce the flate. We can inhibit nodal processing with a cleavage inhibitor for nodal, or block it with lefty. None of that makes any difference. So we were getting desperate. We got down to the left pathway. And actually, so MEK inhibition downstream of FGF kills this community effect, right? So you have this community effect, you treat with MEK inhibitor, and it's gone. So that's great. So then we wanted to say, okay, you know, there's a signaling pathway, right, from MEK to ERK. And so if this is true, we should see a community effect in ERK, and we should see the community effect go away when we treat with an inhibitor. And that part works. And so there's this community effect in ERK. It goes away when you treat with the inhibitor. Right? So here's regular, here's with the inhibitor. But the really puzzling thing is that it's in the wrong direction. Right, so when I treat with the inhibitor, right, all the cells become like the larger colonies. Right, all the colonies become like the larger colonies. But at the level of phenotype, all the cells become like the smaller colony. Right, so there's a community effect that goes away when I treat with the MEK inhibitor. There's a community effect in the thing right downstream of MEK, and it goes the wrong way, and we don't understand this at all. The only idea we have right now is that actually there's this highly related signaling pathway which goes through PI3 kinase and AKT, and people have shown interactions even between ERK and AKT, and if we inhibit MEK, we correspondingly inhibit AKT, so these are just different time points, and AKT has also been shown to promote pluripotency. And this effect looks small, but it's the same effect you get with a direct inhibitor, so I think the antibody is just not very good. So we're trying to see if there's a similar community effect in AKT that goes in the right direction and might explain this effect.
Do you get heterogeneity in the cells and the colonies when you... What exactly do you mean by you get rid of the community effect?
Right? So that's a good question, and that's something a postdoc got asked this exact question at our last group meeting, and I haven't seen the data and the answer to this. So what I mean here is that the colony size no longer matters for this effect. But I think what you're saying is, I believe it's true, but I haven't seen the data yet, right? You should actually see these larger colonies get speckled, right? So it used to be that, right, I get 100% of cells here. Here I get 90% of cells. That could happen in more than one way, right? I could have my colony speckled with those sort of single cells that mess up sitting in the other colonies, or I could just have 10% of colonies get the decision wrong.
The first one, then what do you call it in terms of...
Yeah, so if it's the first one, it's not really a community, it's not really killing the community effect, it's biasing the differentiator. So my gut is that it's the second one, because that's more consistent with our thinking, but I don't have the data to show you. That's a good question. So now we were interested in how the community effect works in differentiation. And here we're lucky because we know we're adding BMP, so we sort of know what the relevant pathway is. We have this reporter, which we can follow in real time. So here's cells. The ligand is added there, and you see the nuclei fill in. And so we can actually watch these cells. We can watch their signaling. And now we're working on staining the same things to assay what the fate looks like as a function of signaling. But I can already tell you a little bit about the differences between the dynamics in these colonies as a function of size. I'm going to skip this, but the point of it was just to say, even this, which I thought was probably the simplest segmentation and tracking problem ever, right? You have these tiny colonies of three cells. It turns out if you want it to be like 100% accurate, like never lose a cell, it's actually really hard. But anyway, we have these traces of single cells and how they signal in time during this differentiation. As I'll show in a minute, if you look at the means of these traces, they're not very different. So if you have one cell colony versus three cell colonies, you average everything, it looks the same. But what you can see immediately from these example traces is that the one cell colonies are sort of all over the place with signaling, whereas the three cell colonies are much, much more consistent. Right? So if I do that over all colonies, right? So here are mean, right? The stimulation is here. The means are sort of indistinguishable, but the three-cell colonies signal much more tightly than the one-cell colonies. So if I plot the variance of these things in three-cell colonies versus one, you see it's much lower. This increase actually is where the signal is supplied, so there's some variability in exactly when they respond to the signal, I think, which persists for a couple of hours and then goes away. But our thinking is that the sort of reinforcement of signaling in the colonies is sort of guiding these all to the same fate. And to prove that, what we really want to do is take these very variable one-cell colonies and ask the cells up here differentiate better than cells down here. That's what we're working on right now. But I think part of this, one thing that's interesting is that this sort of synchronization between the signaling levels predates the stimulation, right? So this idea that BMP4 is a BMP4 target, and so one cell would signal and then bring along its neighbors, that they're sort of synchronized from, negative times, basically.
Do you think that the cell-cell signaling is diffusion or intercellular signaling? Because then the geometry of your package of cells matters, and in one case, presumably diffusion happens quickly enough that... So I guess I was asking...
I don't know that there's a difference in this case, right?
Sorry?
I don't know that there's a difference with colonies that small. All the cells touch each other.
All the cells... Okay, I see.
It's certainly... BMP is an extracellular... Okay, we're stimulating the BMP pathway extracellularly. I think it is possible that, so we've kicked around the idea of, say, blocking ECAT hearing and seeing whether it has an effect on this. But we haven't done.
I guess a more quantitative version of that question is, here you just collapse all the variants. The question is, does your neighbor-neighbor map actually predict two-point correlation?
So that's another thing, right? There's a lot more analysis that
we can do with
this data, correlations between... Cells in the same colony, and so we want to do all that.
Question about how they were seeded. There is this distribution number of cells, but you seeded these little islands, and they divided a few times.
Yes. Okay, so
actually, these little clusters are also sisters or cousins, and conceivably there are some clusters that were colonized by two, so they're kind of two unrelated families.
Yes.
So to speak, sharing the same cluster, and the others are completely cloned.
Yeah, so we're actually interested in that, and we're trying to do rainbow kind of things to say, so if we do that, and then we can distinguish between whether they're sisters or not, are there differences in signaling between sisters and not sisters?
Well, presumably, if you see that the lower density,
they'll all be single cell. That's another way. That's a more straightforward way. You could see the lower density, let them grow for a little while, and now everything is sisters. Yeah, that's true. That's a good idea.
Yeah,
But also amazingly, they do these spinning motions So I guess as the colony gets bigger, that must get more complex, or the ones in the middle. So how do you get the nice stable patterns? Are the cells moving?
These don't pattern, right? They all make the same thing.
Right, because they're small?
Because they're small, right? So the patterns are in colonies of thousands. Yeah, so...
Yeah.
So
how does it affect the motility? Are the cells still spinning around the edge?
I don't think so. We have some live cell imaging data, and they're more jiggling in place. But it would be harder to tell if they were spinning around an individual neighbor. I think there's some interesting transition, right? So here we see the interactions between cells enforcing a common fate. At some point, the interactions between cells make a pattern, and there's some transition there that I think is very interesting, but we're not probing colonies in that plane scale right now. Am I out of time?
No, I think we can keep going.
Okay, that's good, because I made it to stay up late last night to make figures for this. So I'll feel guilty if I don't get at least 5 or 10 minutes for this. So what comes before is sort of a motivator that we really want to understand the signaling dynamics of these pathways. Hopefully you'll remember that you have these two pathways that are both TGF-beta family members that are in a positive feedback loop with each other. And the other thing that's important for what follows is that they both use this common SMAD4. So they have specific things that interact with the receptors, and then SMAD4, after those become activated, SMAD4 complexes with one or the other. And in previous work, we've shown that the upstream SMADs don't correlate very well with the dynamics of transcription, but the SMAD4 in the nucleus does. So we use the SMAD4 in the nucleus as a reporter, but the whether you consider it a drawback or a feature, it reports on both pathways together. So it's makes it more difficult to study one pathway, but is also an opportunity to look at crosstalk between pathways. So to motivate a little bit of what follows, I'd like to show this movie. So this we made with our collaborator who actually we share lab space with. So Dan Wagner has a zebrafish lab. This is the same SMAD4 reporter in a zebrafish embryo, and where you see it going to the nucleus. And I'm not going to really say anything about this other than the patterns of signaling are incredibly complex. And this is really hard to understand. We don't know what the sources of ligands are that lead to these signaling patterns. We don't know when these sources turn on. And so we just don't have good control. And this was actually made with this IMSANE software also. So here's a much more controlled way to look at the SMAD4 response. And this was actually made possible by a good idea that ITSA had, which is we always had trouble because these signaling responses are variable in these colonies because there's patterns from edge to center. But if you want to seed your colonies as single cells, there's ways to basically trick them into thinking they have neighbors. And when you do that, they basically all end up looking like the cells on the edge of the colony. So ITSA had the idea that if we add this chemical that makes them all look like the edge, then we can study these synchronized signaling in large fields of cells. And so, here's the SMAD4 reporter. Here's treating activin. Activin is basically synonymous with nodal, but is easier and cheaper to get. So here's a time course with active signaling. You see that go to the nucleus, and you see that the signaling is adaptive. So this recapitulates some earlier work that I did in some simpler cell lines. To show that this signaling pathway is adaptive, and that this adaptation actually is in the SMAD4, but is not in SMAD2, right? So if I immunostain these same colonies for SMAD2, right, I see SMAD2 stay in the nucleus this whole time, whereas SMAD4 relocalizes back to the cytoplasm. Okay, so the response to activin is adaptive. It's dose-dependent in its amplitude, but not in its duration of signaling. Right? So if I treat with different doses of activin, I always get the same time scale for adaptation, but I get different peaks. This adaptation works through feedback. So we can kill feedback by treating with a protein synthesis inhibitor. And so if you're squeamish, you're about to witness a horrible death of cells. But before they die, we can see that there is no feedback removing this from the nucleus. Right, so when I treat with this protein synthesis inhibitor and activin, right, you see that I accumulate the nucleus much more than I ever did. It never turns around, but the cells really don't like this protein synthesis inhibitor, as you can see. So it's a curious fact, actually, that it kills cells much more effectively in the presence of activin than without. I don't know why. but right, you can see this quantified here, right? So if I, you know, this is my sort of normal active in response here. If I treat with a synthesis, it just goes up and up and up until the cells die. Right? So there's a normally a feedback that needs to be made that removes this from the nucleus. And treating with proteasomal inhibitors has almost no effect. Right? So degradation is not important for killing this response, but feedback is. The other thing that's important for this response is continued signaling activity from the receptors. So if I drop in a drug that kills the kinase activity of the receptors, right, if I drop it in after 1 hour, I get this blue curve, so it shuts off almost immediately. If I drop it in after 2 hours, again, it shuts off almost immediately. So the cells are constantly sensing what's happening at the receptors, and they can kill this adaptive response halfway through if they want to. Okay, so those are a bunch of properties of the activin response. Yeah, I probably don't have time for modeling. But the point of this is just to say, right, you can write down a sort of dead simple model, and this is from you know, my paper with Benoit Sore and Eric. So you write down basically the simplest model you can think of for adaptation, right? You get your typical response. It has this sort of dose-dependent profile. You can kill, if you kill the feedback, right, it does what you would expect. If you kill degradation, it also, so it basically, you know, just a couple parameters, it matches all the data. So basically the only thing you need to know about this pathway to understand all these signaling things is that there's a feedback adaptation and everything else sort of fits. What about the other branch of this pathway, right? So there's this important other branch. It signals basically almost in exactly the same way, right? So separate SMAD, but also binding SMAD4, it does something totally different, right? So it's not adaptive, it just turns on and it stays on. So this is sort of the upstream thing. Okay, it's sort of dose dependent, but not nearly as strongly. So above some amount, they're all the same. And then at lower doses, it starts to decay. And that decay is actually just the cells eating the ligand out of the media. So Itza did a clever experiment to prove that, where he treated one well with BMP and one well not, and then he switched the media in those two wells. And so if it was some or something, right, then, you know, right, the ligand wouldn't have been depleted. But so this is the first well. It was stimulated. You see when you remove the BMP, it goes transfer the media. It just continues right from the first well, right? So it's just really about what's in the media. So this is totally different from the situation with activin, right? And the sort of last two properties I'll mention of this signaling pathway is that as opposed to the activin, where you can just kill the response with a receptor inhibitor, you can only kill half the response with a receptor inhibitor here. And so, and this is very sort of fresh data. And so what we're wondering is whether we're seeing the dynamics of this feedback loop, right? So BMP turns on nodal. Both of these signal through SMAD4. So if I have some nodal response when I kill the BMP receptor, I kill the BMP portion of this trajectory, and then maybe without the feedback loop, the nodal degrades slowly, right? So that's what we're seeing. So actually part of what the students in the course are going to be doing is testing that hypothesis, that what we're seeing is the dynamics of this feedback loop between BMP and nodal. And one last slide showing some curious behavior of, the color's on top, right? Just ignore those gene names on top, sorry. So here's treating with different combinations of BMP and activin, right? So if I treat with BMP, I get this response. If I treat with just activin, I get this response. Now, if I treat with both of them, the curious thing is that the cells always seem to want to go to the same level no matter what, right? So here, let's say I have some residual activin signaling. I hit it with BMP. It's not like it adds this baseline level to the usual BMP response. It just goes to the level that it would usually go with BMP. If I pre-treat with BMP and I give it activin, it has some tiny pulse, which is very small compared to what I usually get, and it relaxes back to this same level. So there seems to be some trade-off between signaling through BMP and signaling through activin that somehow always results in the same levels here, right? And that's actually consistent with this here, right? Because we usually see the BMP. The curious thing about it, the feedback loop turning on and inducing some nodal, is then you would expect signaling to increase, right? So you have signaling through BMP, you turn on nodal, and now that's signaling too. But the signaling is pretty flat in the absence of this. So if you are turning on this feedback loop, the cells are actively replacing the signaling through the BMP with signaling through nodal so that it stays at the same level, but when you kill it, you only kill half of it. It's sort of consistent with this data. So why cells would want to do that, we don't know. But we're sort of working towards understanding this. So the other thing this has done is define some very nice differentiation systems where by modulating these pathways, we can get almost complete conversion of cell phase. Right? So I won't go into the details of the genes, but basically in some minimal media, if you have the right ligands, you maintain pluripotency completely. You switch one ligand, you get complete conversion to endoderm. You remove another ligand, you get complete conversion to ectoderm. So we have these systems where we're looking at these signaling dynamics and see these curious effects. We have these systems where we play with the same pathways and we get almost complete conversions of cell phase. And so the hope is to map from there to these cell phase and then ultimately to the patterns that we see in culture. So I guess I've run a little bit over. So just thank my lab, my collaborators, my mentors where this work was started, and my funding sources. And I'm happy to take more questions if there's time or over lunch. Thanks.
About how the cell density was very important for the response, but you didn't talk about why you thought the cell density was important.
So we're, in contrast to a lot of people here, sort of mechanics is not the first thing on our minds, but it could be. But so my sort of gut thinking is that we've shown that BMP inhibitors are important for restricting the response to the initial BMP, that making nodal is important for converting to mesendoderm, and that making nodal inhibitors is important. And these are all extracellular things. So we think that they accumulate somehow as a function of density. And some support for that is in when you don't have this restriction and you don't have high density, the first things you lose are you lose the ectoderm in the center, right, which is very dependent on these BMP inhibitors, and you lose the endoderm before you lose the mesoderm, which is dependent on building up these high doses of nodal. Right? So we think when you don't have enough density, you can't build up enough BMP inhibitors to keep the BMP response out of the center, and you also can't build up enough nodal to get the highest response to nodal. But I don't think any of that excludes a possible role for mechanical interactions at high densities. We just don't know.
In case where it's adapting and the somatic force coming back out of the nucleus, is that a situation where the ligand is still there, you think? And it now, so now if you raise the concentration of the ligand, you get going back into the nucleus again?
Okay, so I think I actually only made one backup slide and it answers this question. So this is very old data, not well presented, and this was done with Benoit Sor, who's sort of the world's expert on growing cells in microfluidics. So he did these experiments where he increased these doses, right? So you have different levels of ligand. Every line is a feeding, right? And you're feeding with increase. So red is no ligand, and then green is a little bit, blue is a little more, and black is a little more. So you see these SMAD2 go up and up and up, right? Because it's just sensing the ligand levels. And in SMAD4, right, you see these pulses that respond to these ligand levels and relax. So I think, right, so the TGF beta profile kind of looks like that. And then with each increase, you get another pulse. And I think what he saw, though I don't think he ever, it's not included in the set of published data in his paper, is that this happens until you reach a saturating dose. Right? Once you reach a saturating dose, so once this upstream thing saturates, the information no longer propagates downstream. So with each increase in receptor levels, you increase upstream signal transducers, you get a pulse of downstream signal transducers. But at some point, that can't happen anymore. Right? So actually, it's just shown in stem cells, right? If you treat with these high doses of activin, and 6 hours later you treat with another high dose of activin, you get no response. And same with, BMP goes to some fixed level, and you get no response. So he did this in microfluidics. We try to reproduce the experiment, so not quite like this, but we try to reproduce experiments where we give pulses, and the refractory period ends, and then we pulse again. It's astonishingly difficult to remove the ligand to get the response to the second pulse. So you really need very good fluidics and washing and stuff like that.
It would really be quite related to the idea then that Marcus Gonzalez Becan and Frank Hulischer proposed in the Wing Disc for how TPP promotes growth but keeps a uniform proliferation rate, because quantitatively you can get that to work if As the disk grows and the DPP gradient scales, cells are measuring the increase in signal
yes.
within a certain amount of time, mm-hmm. rather than the absolute amount of signal.
Yeah, exactly. So sort of the punchline of some of our earlier, so because I didn't say carefully, a lot of Itz's work, sort of he figured out how to do this in stem cells, and so he was able to sort of recapitulate and enhance upon work that I and Benoit did in Ali, with Ali and Eric, that showed some of these adaptive properties in simpler cell lines in CTC cells. And this is sort of the first evidence that this happens in stem cells. But yeah, the sort of punchline of that work is that, right, cells are measuring derivatives, not really absolute concentrations. And at least sort of on a simple level, that is consistent with this idea that, you know, in the wing, it's sort of derivatives of DPP that regulate growth and not DPP itself.